content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 30th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Trump and Robert Mueller both dressed in kind of colonial era garb. Trump's is sort of maroon. Mueller's is kind of purple with the buttons and the frilly shirts and all that kind of stuff. They're standing back to back, and they're both holding pistols in their hands like they're getting ready for a duel. They're looking over their shoulders at each other. The White House is in the background, and there's a dark cloud in the sky above them. The headline is, "Who'll Strike First?" Trump's growing rage over Mueller's Russia investigation. And I think, in fact, that is our first main story. Trump's new offensive against the Russia probe. What happened? Several Republican lawmakers publicly urged President Trump not to fire Robert Mueller this week after the president openly attacked the special counsel by name for the first time, describing his investigation as a total witch hunt that should have never been started. In a series of angry tweets that alarmed Washington, the president celebrated the controversial dismissal of FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, falsely claimed that Mueller's team contains 13 hardened Democrats and zero Republicans, and insisted there was no collusion. Trump's personal lawyer, John Dowd, later called for an end to the Mueller probe, reportedly on his client's instructions. The president shook up his legal team by adding Joe DiGenova, an outspoken former U.S. attorney who has described the investigation as a deep state conspiracy to frame Donald Trump with a falsely created crime. These developments followed reports that Mueller's team had sent Trump's lawyers a list of questions it wants him to answer, and also has subpoenaed the Trump Organization for business documents related to any dealings with Russia. Senator Lindsey Graham warned that removing the special counsel would be the beginning of the end of Trump's presidency, while Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell insisted Mueller was an excellent appointment who should be allowed to finish the job. Democrats and some Republicans repeated calls to pass a bipartisan bill that would require Trump to get judicial approval of justifications for firing, but GOP leaders insisted the legislation wasn't necessary. McCabe, a 21-year FBI veteran, was fired by Attorney General Jeff Sessions late Friday night, just over 24 hours before he was set to retire and become eligible for a larger pension. His dismissal came after the Justice Department's Inspector General concluded that he had misled investigators over leaks to the media concerning an investigation into the Clinton Foundation. McCabe, who has been publicly lambasted by Trump on Twitter, described the decision to fire him as part of an effort to discredit me as a witness in the Mueller probe. What the editorial said, McCabe probably deserved to be fired, said the Weekly Standard. The Justice Department's nonpartisan Office of the Inspector General is widely respected, and lying to investigators is a cardinal sin for G-men. But because Trump has spent the past year personally criticizing McCabe, claiming he's hopelessly partisan because his wife received campaign funds from Clinton allies while running for the Virginia State Senate in 2015, the focus isn't on whether the dismissal was justified. It's on whether the president's attacks on McCabe, the FBI, and Mueller suggest he has something to hide. Under no circumstances should Trump attempt to fire Mueller, said the New Jersey Star-Ledger. The president may not enjoy having the special counsel's investigation hanging over him, but it has already yielded 22 indictments and 5 guilty pleas. That's no witch hunt. As for Trump's claim that the investigation is politically motivated, Mueller himself is a registered Republican, and so is his supervisor, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Most rational Americans would see the removal of the special counsel as final confirmation that the president must be guilty of something. What the columnist said, Trump has clearly concluded that keeping the gloves off Mueller wasn't working, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. So he's returned to his default approach. Attack, attack, attack. The president's aim now is to discredit the special counsel and his investigation so that his base will discount whatever findings the investigation produces. In the coming weeks and months, expect Trump to go harder after Mueller and his team. A lot harder. The president cannot actually fire Mueller himself, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. That power lies with Rosenstein, who has repeatedly pledged not to remove the special counsel without good cause. To get around that, Trump could fire Rosenstein and work his way down the Justice Department's line of succession until he finds someone willing. Another option is to fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who recused himself from the Russia investigation, and replace him with a Trump loyalist who would severely limit or halt Mueller's work. Both options would be highly risky, triggering a national political earthquake that could end Trump's presidency. Removing Mueller doesn't make sense, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. It would further galvanize Democratic voters ahead of the midterms. And if Democrats did then retake the House, they'd make the firing the basis of impeachment charges. Besides, Mueller's team would almost certainly leak all its findings to lawmakers and newspapers. The only rational reason for the president to take this step would be that he fears some thermonuclear revelation that wouldn't be survivable. Republicans keep saying it would be stupid for Trump to fire Mueller, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But that's based on the assumption the president is innocent. Perhaps Trump is acting guilty because he is guilty. In strongly hinting he's thinking of firing Mueller, Trump just tested Republicans and found strong evidence they'll just squawk and let him get away with it. Given that dynamic and Trump's growing conviction he can trust only his own gut, an attempt to fire Mueller seems not just likely, but inevitable. For our controversy of the week, we have Putin, how the West should respond. It's time to wipe the smirk off Putin's face, said the New York Post in an editorial. While Russia's autocratic president was chest-thumping over his rigged election victory this week, former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter were clinging to life in a British hospital, victims of a chemical weapon attack that Vladimir Putin almost certainly ordered. Putin has suffered no serious consequences for his annexation of Crimea, his invasion of Ukraine, or his bombing of Syrian civilians. But the brazen use of the Russian-made nerve gas Novichok on British soil seems to have finally roused Western nations out of their passivity. As a first step, Britain this week expelled 23 Russian diplomats, while the Trump White House imposed fresh sanctions on 24 Russian firms and individuals already accused of interference in the 2016 U.S. election. Putin has been playing a weak hand well in recent years, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. But with the Skripal attack, he has gone too far. The U.S. should put together a new coalition of the willing, including our NATO and Middle Eastern allies, to answer his reckless provocations with punishment far more painful than limited sanctions and diplomatic wrist slaps. But whose side is President Trump on? Said Michael Crowley in Politico.com. There was a bizarre disconnect between the condemnations of Russia coming out of the Trump administration last week and the mild response of Trump himself. The president opined that the Skripal attack was a very sad situation and said it looks like the Russians were behind it, but expressed no outrage. Over and over again, Trump avoids saying anything negative about Putin, no matter what the Russian strongman does. It's the greatest mystery in American politics. What exactly explains Donald Trump's love affair with Moscow? That question deepened this week when Trump called Putin following the Russian election, said Carol Lenig in the Washington Post. Trump didn't even mention the chemical attack in the chummy call and actually congratulated the Russian autocrat on winning his phony election, despite a specific written warning from his national security advisors, do not congratulate. Trump is shameless, but other Western leaders have been just as pusillanimous, said Max Boot, also in the Washington Post. The Skripal hit, which also sent 36 bystanders to the hospital, was a chemical weapon attack by Russia on a NATO member state. Sending a few diplomats home won't do. No one would recommend a military response, but invoking the NATO Common Defense Clause would certainly get Putin's attention. So would ejecting Russia from the international banking system and freezing the billions he and his oligarch pals have stashed in Western banks and real estate. The U.S. and its allies should hit Putin and his cronies where it counts. Or we could just expose Putin as the kleptocrat he is, said the WashingtonExaminer.com. Despite his authoritarian control of Russia, he's deeply insecure and fears a popular uprising. That's why he jails and/or kills journalists, activists, and political opponents who shine a light on his corruption. Our strongest move would be to help Russian journalists and dissidents get and publicize the embarrassing details of how Putin has looted Russia's resources for his own enrichment. To contain this international gangster, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal, we need to take a page out of The Godfather. What's needed is a horse's head in somebody's bed. Only when Vlad feels real fear will he stop treating the West with such arrogant disdain. It was a good week for shouting at each other. After the Nielsen Company reported that 26 of the 40 most watched programs on cable TV last week were political shows on Fox News and MSNBC. Just three scripted entertainment programs made the list. It was a good week for a little less shouting after retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters resigned as a strategic analyst for Fox News, saying the network had become a mere propaganda machine for a destructive and ethically ruinous administration and is fostering corrosive and unjustified paranoia among viewers. And it was a good week for Sir Ringo Starr, the former Beatles drummer, who was knighted this week by Britain's Prince William for his services to music. "It means a lot, actually," said Starr, 77. But it was a bad week for dignity after White House Chief of Staff John Kelly told reporters that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was sitting on the toilet when he learned he was going to be fired. It was a bad week for working too hard after a self-employed French baker in the town of Luçon-sur-Barse was fined the equivalent of $3,600 for violating a labor law that requires all workers to take at least one day off per week. "These kinds of laws are killing our businesses," said town mayor Christian Braun. And finally, it was a bad week for credentials after a former New York lawmaker dismissed Cynthia Nixon, the Sex and the City actor running in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, as an unqualified lesbian. Former City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, herself a lesbian, later clarified that she considers Nixon unqualified, period. On the briefing page, we have the Starr investigation, S-T-A-R-R. How did Ken Starr's investigation into President Clinton resemble and differ from the ongoing Mueller investigation? Why was Clinton investigated? It began over the Whitewater scandal, a long-running controversy concerning a failed 1978 land deal in Arkansas. Clinton's business partner in that project defrauded a small savings association and an investment firm, and some of the parties involved charged that the president and his wife had benefited from the fraud. In January 1994, Attorney General Janet Reno appointed Robert Fisk as a special prosecutor to investigate the Clintons' involvement. 7 months later, however, a Republican-leaning panel of judges dismissed Fisk on the basis that his appointment by Clinton's attorney general represented a conflict of interest, and appointed Ken Starr as an independent counsel, reporting to Congress, not to the Justice Department. Starr, who had served as Solicitor General under President George H.W. Bush, was a staunch Republican. Clinton loyalists immediately cried foul, denouncing the probe as tainted and a partisan witch hunt. "This will last as long as Clinton is president and beyond," warned White House counsel Bernard Nussbaum. "They'll be investigating things years from now that we haven't even dreamed about today." Were those fears realized? Yes. While Starr ultimately found no criminal wrongdoing by the Clintons regarding Whitewater, he broadened his investigation to include many other controversies swirling around the White House. In January 1998, a civil servant named Linda Tripp told Starr's team she had recordings of Monica Lewinsky, a former White House intern, discussing an 18-month affair she'd had with the president. With Reno's approval, Starr expanded his investigation to include Lewinsky. The president fiercely denied the affair with Lewinsky, first in a sworn affidavit while testifying in a case involving Paula Jones, an Arkansas state employee who had accused Clinton of sexual harassment, and then to reporters and the public saying, I did not have sex with that woman. What did Starr do? He built a comprehensive case that Clinton was lying by compelling White House staff and Secret Service members to testify. After 6 months of negotiations to get Clinton to testify, Starr subpoenaed the president, and Clinton agreed to testify voluntarily for a grand jury with his lawyers present. That precedent now hangs over the negotiations taking place between Mueller and Trump's legal team over whether the current president will testify in the Russia investigation. No matter how much huffing and puffing Trump's lawyers do, said Lanny Davis, Clinton's former special counsel, they cannot escape a grand jury issued subpoena. What happened in the interview? Clinton admitted that he'd had inappropriate, intimate contact with Lewinsky, but he insisted he hadn't perjured himself during the Jones case, arguing that he understood, quote, sexual relations to mean sexual intercourse, not oral sex, and denied instructing Lewinsky and others to lie to investigators. Starr submitted his report to Congress 3 weeks later, and lawmakers voted to make it public. The 445-page document specified 11 possible grounds for impeachment, mostly related to the cover-up. In December, the GOP-controlled House of Representatives voted almost entirely along party lines to impeach Clinton for perjury, 228-206, and obstruction of justice, 221-212. Two other charges were voted down. But after a 5-week trial in the Senate, Clinton was acquitted on both charges. All 45 Democratic senators voted not guilty on the obstruction charge, along with 5 Republicans, and the 50 guilty votes fell far short of the 67 required to oust Clinton from office. On the perjury charge, 55 senators voted not guilty. How does Mueller's probe compare? Unlike Starr, who gave interviews, Mueller has adopted a very low profile, and there have been few, if any, leaks from his team. But their tactics are similar. Starr persuaded Lewinsky and other witnesses to cooperate by threatening them with long jail terms for lying, just as Mueller has done. Also familiar are the aggressive attempts by Trump's backers to discredit Mueller. During the Starr investigation, Senator Pat Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, claimed the independent counsel was totally out of control and fixated on trying to topple the president. Clinton aides demanded an investigation into the investigation. Democratic lawmakers called on Starr to step down. Clinton only survived, says Dick Morris, one of his former advisors, because he made Ken Starr the enemy. Can Trump do the same? He will certainly try. Clinton supporters had more basis for their complaints. Starr was a partisan Republican when he was appointed. Mueller is a lifelong Republican who was appointed FBI director by George W. Bush, although several of his investigators are Democrats. Because the charges against Clinton primarily involved a private sexual affair, the public generally took a dim view of Starr's charges. Clinton's approval ratings soared to their highest ever level during their impeachment. That dynamic reinforced the Democrats' strong showing in the 1998 midterms, convinced senators that removing the president from office over the Lewinsky affair would be political suicide. A similar principle applies with Mueller's investigation. If he finds grounds for impeachment, public opinion will serve as the ultimate jury, and Congress's decision about whether or not to oust Trump will be largely a political calculation. Moving into the best columns of the week, we take two this week from the U.S. The first is titled, Hillary's Deplorable Worldview. Hillary Clinton just can't stop insulting voters, said Christian Schneider. As a presidential candidate, Clinton famously called supporters of Donald Trump deplorables, and at a speaking engagement in India this last week, she bitterly elaborated on the faults of the people who denied her the presidency. Trump, she complained, appealed to white men who oppose black people getting rights and women getting jobs. While millions of sheep-like white women voted for Trump because of ongoing pressure to vote the way that your husband, your boss, your son, whoever, believes you should. Actually, Clinton lost because her elitist condescension repelled so many voters. Democrats should be alarmed. In the 2018 midterm elections, they must win over Rust Belt and blue-collar voters whom Clinton clearly reviles. She remains as toxic as ever, and her disdain for the heartland is pumping oxygen to the jackals at Fox News. Most former candidates accept defeat and become more popular. In fact, being a losing presidential candidate is one of the best jobs in America. Yet no ex-candidate has ever been worse at it than Clinton. If Democrats want to win future elections, they must distance themselves from Clinton and beg her to act with some dignity. Fox News off the deep end. It's easy to understand why conservatives, especially older conservatives, feel affection for Fox News, said David French. When the network launched in 1996, it provided a necessary, healthy dose of competition to a left-leaning legacy media. But as Fox came to dominate conservative discourse, it started to attract a constellation of cranks and grifters, peddling sensationalistic conspiracy theories and unhinged partisanship. Last summer, Fox reporters and commentators Sean Hannity and Newt Gingrich relentlessly promoted the conspiracy theory that a Democratic operative named Seth Rich, whom police say was killed in a Washington, D.C. street robbery, was actually assassinated by Democrats. Without any evidence whatsoever, Fox claimed it was Rich and not Russian hackers who had actually given embarrassing Democratic emails to WikiLeaks. The network's obvious goal, to debunk the Russian hacking narrative and protect Donald Trump. Now Rich's parents are suing the network, saying it used a fake story to portray their son as a traitor and exploit his death for political reasons. Conservatives do need an alternative to the mainstream media, but a network that traffics in wild conspiracy theories is anything but fair and balanced. And for our international column, we'll take one of the How They See Us columns, this one titled, An Iran Hawk as Chief Diplomat. The replacement of Rex Tillerson with Mike Pompeo as U.S. Secretary of State will be good for the U.S. and good for Israel, said the Jerusalem Post from Israel in an editorial. Tillerson never had any influence on President Trump, who often mocked the former Exxon boss. But Pompeo has proved during his year heading the CIA that he can sway the president, not least by his use of killer graphics in his daily intelligence briefings. Most important, the two hold the same worldview. Unlike Tillerson, Pompeo shares Trump's opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. The 2015 agreement that waived international sanctions on Tehran in exchange for the regime limiting its nuclear programs. Pompeo has rightfully called the Obama-era pact a disastrous deal with the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. He will firmly back Trump if the president scuttles the deal when it comes up for recertification in May, unless European nations agree to new restrictions on Iran, inspections at all nuclear sites, an extension to the ban on most nuclear research, and limits on the development of long-range missiles. Pompeo has his own reasons for belligerence against Iran, said Iran's Tabnak.ir. Before his stint at the CIA, he represented the U.S. congressional district that includes Wichita, home to Koch Industries, a big player in the U.S. shale oil. The company is owned by the Koch brothers, Republican mega donors who hate the nuclear deal because it has increased Iran's oil exports, lowering the global oil price. Breaking the deal will mean the return of Iran's oil sanctions, rising oil prices, and more profits for the Koch brothers. But Iran won't take such a betrayal lying down. As Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has warned, pulling out of the nuclear deal would be a painful mistake for the Americans. Pompeo may welcome such Iranian threats, which he'll use to argue for regime change, said Shahir Shahidatlis in the UK-based MiddleEastEye.net. A fervent evangelical Christian, Pompeo accused the Obama administration in 2015 of consistently siding with the Islamic East against the Christian West. He won't be satisfied with mere tweaks to the nuclear agreement. He seeks the overthrow of the mullahs. With Pompeo egging Trump on, we could see a U.S.-Iran military confrontation. Iran isn't even the most pressing world threat, said the Toronto Star. The first priority for the White House is to defuse the ticking time bomb that is North Korea. Trump said he would meet with dictator Kim Jong-un by May, but since Pompeo doesn't believe Kim can be negotiated with, he'll likely recommend a military option instead. Tillerson was a lousy steward of the State Department, but at least he encouraged the president to work with allies rather than go it alone. In Pompeo, Trump has found someone who will reinforce his most aggressive attitudes and never advise caution. What could possibly go wrong? Time for the last word. Our in-depth article title this week is Unplugging from the News Completely. When Donald Trump won the White House, Eric Hagerman decided to retreat to an Ohio pig farm and live the life of a hermit, said journalist Sam Dalnick. He knows nothing about what's happened since. Gloucester, Ohio. At first, the experiment didn't have a name. Right after the election, Eric Hagerman decided he'd take a break from reading about the hoopla of politics. President Donald Trump's victory shook him badly. And so Hagerman developed his own eccentric experiment, one that was part silent protest, part coping mechanism, part extreme self-care plan. He swore that he would avoid learning about anything that happened to the United States after November 8, 2016. It was draconian and complete, he said. It's not like I wanted just to steer away from Trump or shift the conversation. It was like I was a vampire and any photon of Trump would turn me to dust. It was just going to be for a few days, but he is now more than a year into knowing almost nothing about U.S. politics. He has managed to become shockingly uninformed during one of the most eventful chapters in modern U.S. history. He is as ignorant as contemporary citizen could ever hope to be. James Comey, Russia, Robert Mueller, Las Vegas, the travel ban, alternative facts, pussy hats, Scaramucci, Parkland, big nuclear buttons, Roy Moore, he knows none of it. To Hagerman, life is a spoiler. I just look at the weather, said Hagerman, 53, who lives alone on a pig farm in southeastern Ohio. But, he added, it's only so diverting. He says he's gotten used to a feeling that he hadn't experienced in a long time. I am bored, he said, but it's not bugging me. It takes meticulous planning to find boredom. Hagerman commits as hard as a method actor, and his self-imposed regimen, white noise tapes at the coffee shop, awkward scolding of friends, a ban on social media, has reshaped much of his life. Extreme as it is, it's a path that likely holds some appeal for liberals these days, a do-it-yourself version of moving to Canada. The fact that it's working for him, I'm emotionally healthier than I've ever felt, he said, has made him question the very value of being fed each day by the media. Why do we bother tracking faraway political developments and distant campaign speeches? What good comes of it? Why do we read all these tweets anyway? I have been paying attention to the news for decades, Hagerman said, and I never did anything with it. At some point last year, he decided his experiment needed a name. He considered the embargo, but it sounded too temporary. The boycott. It came off a little whiny. Hagerman has created a fortress around himself. Tiny little boats of information can be dangerous, he said. He decided that it would be called the blockade. For a guy who has gone to great lengths to essentially plug his ears, Hagerman sure does talk a lot. He is witty and discursive, punctuating his stories with wild-eyed grins, exaggerated grimaces, and more than the occasional lost thread. I recently spent 2 days visiting his farm on the condition that I not bring news from the outside world. As the sun set over his porch, turning the rolling hills pink, then purple, then blue, he held forth, jumping from English architecture to the local pig's eating habits, to his mother's favorite basketball team, to the philosophy of Kant. He can go days without seeing another soul. This life is still fairly new. A few years ago, he was a corporate executive at Nike. Senior Director of Global Digital Commerce was his official unwieldy title, working with teams of engineers to streamline the online shopping experience. Before that, he had worked digital jobs at Walmart and Disney. I worked 12, 14-hour days, he said, the calendar completely booked. But 3 years ago, he decided he had saved enough money to move to a farm, make elliptical sculptures, and eventually opt out of the national conversation entirely. He lives alone and has never married. As for money, a financial advisor in San Francisco manages his investments. Hagerman says he throws away the quarterly updates without reviewing them. Hagerman grew up in southeastern Ohio, and after years spent in Brooklyn warehouses, San Francisco tech bubbles, and Nike land in Portland, Oregon, the idea of a quiet life became more and more appealing. His mother lives nearby. He sees her a lot since he moved back in 2016. She reluctantly adheres to the blockade, although they do discuss the Cleveland Cavaliers. Hagerman begins every day with a 30-minute drive to Athens, the closest city of note, to get a cup of coffee, a triple-shot latte with whole milk. He goes early before most customers have settled into the oversized chairs to scroll through their phones. To make sure he doesn't overhear idle chatter, he often listens to white noise through his headphones. He used to listen to music, but stray conversation can creep in between songs. At Donkey Coffee, everyone knows his order, and they know about the blockade. Our baristas know where he's at, so they don't engage him on topics that would make him uncomfortable, said Angie Pyle, the coffee shop's co-owner. Hagerman has also trained his friends. A close friend from his Nike days, Paranaz Vahabzadeh, didn't think he was serious at first, and in the early days of the blockade, kept dropping little hints about politics. The new administration compelled her to engage more deeply in politics, not less. She had only recently become a U.S. citizen, and she was passionate about the immigration debate. She did not let Hagerman opt out easily. I was needling him, she said. In response, she received, for the first time, a stern text message. I am now officially cross with you, he wrote. As you know very well, I don't wish to hear about current events. I know you don't agree with my wishes, but I do expect you to respect them. They now speak on the phone several times a week, but never about the news. I've gotten used to it, she said. It's actually nice to not talk about politics. Conversations with Hagerman can have a Rip Van Winkle quality. He spoke several times about his sister, Bonnie, an assistant professor who lives in, of all places, Charlottesville, Virginia. While he and I were talking, I looked over at him at every mention of Charlottesville to see if the name of the city, home to perhaps the ugliest weekend of the Trump era to date, made him flinch. So, do you associate Charlottesville, I would say the name deliberately and with emphasis, with anything besides your sister? He didn't bite. I think he really didn't know about the Nazis. Later, he pointed to a house on a hill and said that before the election, the neighbor had decorated his lawn with an effigy of Hillary Clinton behind bars. I wanted to point out that the recently unveiled Mueller indictment found that a Russian troll had paid for a Hillary impersonator at a Florida rally. But I bit my tongue. Hagerman didn't know about Mueller or Russia or trolls. Last winter, Hagerman spent several weeks visiting his twin brother, a tech CEO in San Francisco. Strict arrangements had to be made. The Sunday newspaper kept out of sight, the TV switched off, his teenage niece and nephew under special instructions. The bigger challenge was when we would have friends come over and visit, said his brother Chris. We had to have Eric not be there, or we would give him a heads up that Eric had this news blockade going, and we gave them the guidelines. They were always a little bemused by it, and to some extent, envious, he said. The prospect of just chucking all that for a period of time felt somewhat appealing. To be fair, Hagerman has made a few concessions. He reads the New Yorker's art reviews, but is careful to flip past the illustrated covers, which often double as political commentary. He watches every Cavaliers game, but only on mute. He counts a few boats that have sailed past the blockade. He saw a picture of Kim Jong-un on a newspaper at a coffee shop, signaling that something was up with North Korea. And he overheard someone saying something about Obamacare, which meant health care was back in the news. His brother alerted him to the Equifax breach for his own protection. But the blockade has been pretty damn effective, Hagerman said. He said that with some pride, but he has misgivings about disengaging from political life. The first several months of this thing, I didn't feel all that great about it, he said. It makes me a crappy citizen. It's the ostrich head in the sand approach to political outcomes you disagree with. It seems obvious to say, but to avoid current affairs is in some ways a luxury that many people, for example, immigrants worried about deportation, cannot afford. He has the privilege of constructing a world in which very little of what he doesn't have to deal with gets through, said his sister Bonnie. That's a privilege. We all would like to construct our dream worlds. Eric is just more able to do it than others. What if, he began to think, he could address his privilege and the idea of broader good near to home? He has a master project, one he thinks about obsessively, that he believes can serve as his contribution to American society. He calls it the lake. On a recent spookily warm day, Hagerman clambered up a steep bank of woods, pushing past vines and stepping past fallen logs. Wide-eyed, giddy with excitement, he led the way to a flat stretch of brush where he spread his arms and began talking even faster than usual. This is where we'll build a giant barn. It will feel like a cathedral. The cloister will be there, he said, making reference to Chartres and Oxford and the grandeur of medieval cathedrals. At about 9 months ago, he bought some 45 acres on the site of a former strip mine. The property, untouched for decades, has been reclaimed by nature. Deer, beavers, salamanders, and canopies of majestic trees are thriving. He sees this land as his life's work. He plans to restore it, protect it, live on it, and then preserve it for the public. I will never sell this land, he said. He wouldn't put it exactly this way, but he talks about the land in part as penance for the moral cost of the blockade. I see it as a contribution that has civic relevance that aligns with my passions and what I do well, Hagerman said. I'm going to donate it. I'm going to take most of my net worth. Oh, it's going to take most of my net worth. That's what I'm going to spend the rest of my money on. He has filled an entire room of his house with a 3D rendering of the property to better envision his plans. He has hired Gary Conley, a local landscape ecologist, to advise the project. Conley, a gentle bearded outdoorsman who can speak at length about the preferences of the local amphibians, believes that the land could become something special. Conley indulges Hagerman's fantasies for the land, a walkway modeled on an ancient Mayan ball game, land art inspired by spiral jettle, windows and concrete blocks. So many blocks. But Conley mainly serves as the straight man to inject ecological reality into the plan. Conley respects the blockade. After all, the project of the lake might not exist without it. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll get one of the obituaries this week. The visionary physicist who brought cosmology to the masses, Stephen Hawking, 1942-2018. In 1963, Stephen Hawking was told that he had 2 years to live. The 21-year-old cosmology student at the University of Cambridge had been diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, a neuromuscular wasting disease also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The condition would eventually rob him of his voice and control over almost his entire body, except for a muscle in his right cheek, which he would twitch to operate his speech generation computer. Yet his ALS developed far more slowly than predicted. Over the next 55 years, Hawking would become one of the world's leading cosmologists, a pioneering thinker on black holes, objects so massive that not even light can escape their gravity, and a star among theoretical physicists. But it was his skill and wit in translating complex concepts into ordinary language that made him a global celebrity. My goal is simple, he once said. It is complete understanding of the universe, why it is as it is, and why it exists at all. Hawking was born in Oxford on January 8, 1942. The 300th anniversary of Galileo's death, he liked to point out, said the Washington Post. The son of a research biologist father and a Liberal Party activist mother, he was a mediocre student, despite an obvious streak of brilliance that prompted his friends to nickname him Einstein. At Oxford University, he found his physics studies so easy that he worked only an hour a day, giving him plenty of time to carouse with fellow boat club members. He graduated with the highest possible honors and went to Cambridge to pursue a cosmology PhD. Not long into his studies, Hawking noticed that his movements were becoming clumsy and awkward, said the Los Angeles Times. Diagnosed with ALS, he plunged into depression and skipped his doctoral work, occupying himself by drinking, listening to Wagner records, and reading science fiction. But his black mood lifted as the progression of his disease slowed unexpectedly. In 1965, he married Jane Wild, a linguistics student, giving him another reason to live. I started working hard for the first time in my life, Hawking said. To my surprise, I found that I liked it. While he declined physically, his body of work increased, said the Times. Unable to write out long strings of equations, Hawking attacked problems geometrically through pictures and diagrams. Using this technique, he reached a profound realization on black holes. They could shine. Hawking found that black holes leak thermal radiation from subatomic processes at their edges, emanations now known as Hawking radiation, and can potentially evaporate over eons. The discovery moved science one step closer toward a theory of everything that could reconcile newer theories of quantum physics, the study of the strange behavior of the smallest particles in the universe, with Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, essential for understanding the gravity of black holes. But it was a brief history of time that rocketed Hawking to stardom, said The Guardian. A popular science account of fundamental physics and the birth of the universe, the 1988 book would sell more than 11 million copies and make him a global celebrity. With the aid of a voice synthesizer, controlled first by his fingers and finally by his cheek, the wheelchair-bound Hawking gave speeches around the world, expounding on everything from space exploration to the dangers of artificial intelligence. The public, said the New York Times, came to regard him as a rolling Delphic oracle. Hawking refused to be constrained by his disability or notions of how a public intellectual should behave. He appeared on Star Trek, The Next Generation, and The Simpsons, and in 2007 took part in a zero-gravity flight aboard a specially equipped Boeing 727 that allowed him to float through the cabin as if he were in space. Hawking never stopped working. His final paper on how mankind might detect parallel universes was submitted 2 weeks before his death. Through it all, he maintained his cosmic perspective, telling interviewers that he didn't fear death, having grappled with the mysteries of the cosmos. They're named black holes because they are related to human fears of being destroyed or gobbled up, said Hawking. I don't have fears of being thrown into them. I understand them. I feel, in a sense, that I am their master. On the Health and Science page, we've got a baseball article called Home Run Weather. Traditional baseball wisdom says that pitchers are ahead of the hitters when the season starts in the chilly early spring, while on the hot days of summer, scoring and home runs soar. There is a real scientific reason for that phenomenon, says PopularScience.com. Struck baseballs fly farther on the hot, humid days of summer. Heat causes gases to expand, which reduces air density or the number of molecules packed into one space. As a result, baseballs face less resistance as they fly through the air on a hot day. For a ball hit at the typical home run speed and trajectory, a 10 degree Fahrenheit change in temperature is worth about a little over 3 feet in distance, said physics professor Alan Nathan. Altitude and humidity also affect the flight of a baseball. Humid air holds more water vapor, which displaces heavier gases like nitrogen and oxygen. The resulting reduction in air density allows batters to knock them out of the park more easily. Air density also lowers at high altitude. Is also lower at higher altitudes, which is why Coors Field, the mile-high home of the Colorado Rockies, is known as a hitter's haven and a pitcher's worst nightmare. Nathan says wind can have the most pronounced effect of all. Even a 5-mile-per-hour wind blowing toward the outfield can carry a fly ball an extra 20 feet, the difference between an out and a dinger. And that leaves us just time for a few shorter notes. We have the happiest country in the world is Finland. According to the UN's annual World Happiness Report, the U.S. came in 18th out of 156 countries on a rating system based on income, life expectancy, freedom, social support, trust, and generosity. Black men raised in even the wealthiest families and most well-to-do neighborhoods earn less in adulthood than white men with similar backgrounds, according to a major new study. The gap doesn't exist for black women raised in wealthy families and neighborhoods. The Pentagon spent almost $140,000 at Trump-branded properties in the first 8 months of the Trump presidency. Military personnel spent about $59,000 on lodging and food at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida, $9,618 at Trump's Bedminster, New Jersey golf club, and $35,652 at the Trump International Las Vegas Hotel. On the poll watch, we have 80% of Americans believe that the government is spying on its own citizens, and just 18% think the spying is usually justified. And that leaves us time for a couple of quotes today. We'll start with one from philosopher Karl Popper. He says, "The aim of argument should not be victory, but progress." And this from one of my favorite authors, John Updike, quoted in brainpickings.org. He says, "Each day we wake slightly altered, and the person we were yesterday is dead." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments or questions? Please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.